versus Ashley. We'll hear first from Mr. Abner.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Representative Marlo Ashley, who's serving a life sentence for trafficking in cocaine. We raised three issues in this case, and I'm going to take them in the order that I was presented in the brief, unless the court wants to hear them in some other order. First issue is whether the evidence in this case was sufficient. This was an entirely circumstantial case. To be sure, some of the circumstances raised some questions about what Mr. Ashley and Ms. Atkins were doing. Most particularly, why is she riding in a car while he's on a bus going to the same location? On the other hand, what does that tell you about whether or not it's he was responsible for the cocaine that was in the luggage? It's not clear what that tells you. If they're going to bring cocaine to Shreveport, why not put it in the car? Why not both of them ride in the car?
Counsel, is your argument basically there's suspicious conduct, you concede that, but whether the suspicions support what is necessary here is where you draw an issue?
That's correct, sir. Maybe they were having an affair. I don't know. Because, you know, the police were looking for a Mr. Atkins when they arrested Mr. Ashley, which would have been Ms. Atkins' husband, we assume. It's just not clear.
Would that just be the name on the checked bag?
No, they were looking for a specifically named man, Mr. Atkins, and it's
that's who bought the ticket.
No, Miss Atkins bought the ticket. Markiah Atkins.
Right. But Atkins was the name on the ticket.
Yeah, and for some, on the ticket. For some reason, the police, and we don't know why in the from this record, they were looking for apparently this woman's husband, and we're not sure why. But, you know, on the other side of this, you've got a woman. She's a ticket counter clerk. She's got a photographic memory. She remembers everything in great detail, what this man was wearing, his wristwatch, what restaurant she sent those two to. And she also remembers this man getting on the bus. He's carrying a white plastic shopping bag and another bag. But there's no mention of a suitcase. She never saw a suitcase. She was never asked to identify a suitcase. So all we know is he gets on a bus, he comes to Shreveport, he gets off a bus, walks straight out of there, gets on the phone like he's calling Miss Atkins to pick him up, doesn't make any effort to pick up a bag, doesn't have a claim check on him. Miss Atkins gets arrested. She apparently doesn't have a claim check on her either. If she did, we would have seen it. And
the fact is, only one person got on that bus in Humble, Texas, and that was the defendant. There was one ticket sold, and that was to Ms. Atkins.
Correct.
So there's one bag on the bus from Humble, Texas, and that one has the cocaine in it.
There is a bag that indicates it came from Humble, Texas. I mean, that basically... You know, we have to make some assumptions here. Did that bag go on that bus on that day in Humble? There is a tag that indicates it did. Nobody saw that suitcase go on there. And so, you know, you have to make some inferences.
I'm not sure I understand the facts that you're trying to highlight for us. The tag with the handwriting on it that says from Humble through Humble for some reason to Shreveport. That tag was on the bag that had the cocaine in it.
Yes, that is correct.
And the ticket agent or whatever in Humble did identify her handwriting on that tag.
She did. Yes, she does.
Okay. So as far as the circumstance, the only circumstance that's not testified to is that tag got affixed in Humble to this particular bag with the cocaine. Now, where else would you say you would have to rely on circumstantial evidence?
You need to infer that first of all, she does identify her handwriting. She doesn't say this is the tag that I wrote on that day. So there's an inference. This is a small one.
Keep us focused.
Okay. Sure. You have to infer that the bag, that bag did go on the bus at that time. I'm not sure how it could have gone at another time. But you also have to infer how did it get there? If Mr. Ashley doesn't seem putting it there, something is unusual. Something's up. And did Ms. Atkins put that?
Why wouldn't it be understandable if somebody would want to try to disassociate themselves from a bag that has contraband in it?
That certainly does make sense, but how does he do that in this case? I mean,
well, he doesn't have the tag on him, and he's not the one who bought the ticket.
I mean, ultimately, that's going to be true for anyone on the bus,
he's the only one who got on the bus in Humboldt.
That's what this witness recalls. Well,
what you have to infer is that every one of these micro steps is calculated to disassociate in case at any place along that timeline there's a bobble.
Yes.
And one of them would be not to have the ticket. Another would be to have clothes that don't fit you. Because he's not trying to get his clothes there if the conviction was correct. He's only trying to get the contraband there. If that's found, he doesn't want the ticket, he doesn't want clothes that fits him, he doesn't want to be seen putting the tag on the bag, then that's why they do a teamwork.
Yes, certainly he doesn't want to be associated with that bag.
At any step along that line, from the time they got there till the time he got off the bus and claimed a bag without a ticket. And plenty of people lose tickets, claim checks.
Then when he got to Shreveport, he and Atkins both denied knowing each other, yet their cell phones had text messages back and forth to each other.
There's no question that...
You know, that denial is pretty good evidence of guilty knowledge, isn't it?
Of something, yes. But again, you know... Why do they? What? It's not clear why they're even putting cocaine on a bus. If she's got a car that she's taking here to Shreveport.
Well, she doesn't want to get stopped in an ordinary traffic stop and have it there. We have a zillion cases of traffic stops.
This is true.
Contraband.
Yes, and then on the other hand, you've got a man who knows that the police will stop a bus and look at all the luggage on it, and see if there's cocaine.
If they have a tip.
Yes. Well, and the same applies in a car. I mean, you seem to be making things harder for yourself. And then he's traveling on a ticket that's not in his name. Now, why is he doing that? Well, there's nothing about that makes sense, except the fact that he probably doesn't have ID. In fact, he does not have an ID when he's arrested. And you can't buy a ticket without an ID. But moving on to briefly to another issue, I believe the second issue in the brief. Sure, you can put anybody's clothes in there. You don't. If you're trying to disassociate yourself, you might not put your clothes and your ID in there. But why would you put someone else's clothes? Why put clothes at all? There's no need for that.
But didn't Judge Wiener, already smart man that he is, give us a reason for that? One more way to distance himself if they are caught?
Yes. But on this, given the issue here, the question is, that is an explanation for putting something else in the bag. But at the same time, if the clothes, you know, if a suitcase has clothes in it that aren't yours, that is at least some evidence that supports your argument that it's not your suitcase. Oh, yes, you could have done that. And you're not arguing that if the clothes don't fit, you know, you have to quit. But you have a defense here. And the defense is, it's not my bag. It's got a man's clothing in it. That tends to make more probable that the suitcase belongs to the man who wears those clothes.
Remind me what the specific ruling by the district judge was. Did he find them not relevant? Did he find that whatever the evidence of the clothes not fitting, if that in fact were true, did he say that wasn't relevant, or where did he draw the line?
Well, his initial words were cumulative, worthless, and useless evidence.
Which rule is that?
I'm not sure. But he then explained, explicitly, he told counsel that the evidence establishes the government has made the connection between the bag and Mr. Atkins, and therefore, who cares whose clothes he put in the bag? And to me, that is putting the cart before the horse. It's begging the question. You know, it's for the jury to decide whether the government has made the connection. And as I was trying to explain, it's certainly not dispositive, and there's good explanations perhaps for putting someone else's clothes in, but it is not irrelevant to the defense that it's not your suitcase. So he should have, you know, being relevant, there being absolutely no prejudice to the government to allow this to.
Do we know whether the clothes fit or not?
Well, this is a man, the record shows he's 5'11", 180 pounds. If you look at the clothes in the evidence, just in the record, there's some T-shirts that are double X and triple extra large. There's some pants in there. I don't recall if the size is on them. They're large looking. And, you know, one of the witnesses, they were large, but, you know, that's where they wear them these days. And it was the defense counsel was trying to show that no reasonable person would wear clothing like this large.
Well, counsel, let's say you showed, or could have shown that these did not fit him. Don't you then have to show some sort of prejudice on the evidentiary ruling the district court made?
Well, the prejudice you have to show is that the jury didn't get to see this guy in ridiculously large clothes. And showing that on appeal is admittedly difficult because we don't have the defendant in this courtroom. We don't have the clothes in this courtroom. And even and to that point, you know, defense counsel didn't proffer the defendant in those clothing. I'm not sure the judge would have allowed him to do it. But if he had, we still wouldn't be able to see it here on appeal. So it is admittedly difficult, but then this is the type of issue where, you know, very powerful evidence is always going to be difficult to show the prejudice on. As I said, you've got, you know, you've got the clothing.
Yeah, but that knife cuts two ways. If they're trying to show disassociation, then that's favorable to the government that it doesn't fit. That's one more thing they did to disassociate.
Well,
I read the judge as saying it's irrelevant one way or the other.
Well, that is what he's saying.
Yeah.
And he's saying that because, you know, because they could put this in to, you know, to distance himself from the clothing. But it does cut two ways, and the defense has an argument to make, and that's, you know, his right to make that argument, convince the jury that it cuts his way more. Moving to the last issue, you know, this trial opened up with a story by a Nacogdoches police officer telling about how he boarded a bus and learned that one of the passengers, Mr. Ashley, was in personal possession of crack cocaine, and that he was traveling with a ticket from Monroe to Houston, and it was in somebody else's name. Now, defense counsel understandably cross-examine this witness with the purpose of making it clear to the jury that this was not the crime for which he was on trial. And that little effort backfired because the witness responded, I believe that it is the same crime, just a different episode. And the judge understandably stepped in and instructed the jury that it could only consider that evidence for various reasons. And then the court went down the list of 404B reasons, the exceptions to other crimes, the use of other crimes evidence. Now, of course, at this time, the jury hadn't heard any evidence. They didn't and couldn't make much sense of that curative instruction, such as it was. And the first that this jury heard about how it was supposed to use this evidence was during closing argument when the government told it that it was evidence of intent or state of mind. And what the government said was, he was on a bus with cocaine before. He was traveling on another ticket. So it'd be a really wild coincidence if that cocaine wasn't his this time. And the problem here is that what the government is talking about intent, but it's really arguing propensity. He did it before. He probably did it again. And, you know, in other words, here's a man who has a character that involves dealing in cocaine. He probably acted in conformity therewith.
Was that objected to? Was that argument objected to?
The argument itself was not objected to. The use of the the evidence was.
Well, let me ask, did the judge not give some indication when this evidence first came in that this would be used only for the purposes that the lawyers would be explained under 404B terms? So when did the jurors first get told that these that this was being introduced for some other purpose?
The jurors were first, and believe only ever, told of this after, you know, the trial opened with this witness. They had not yet.
So there's no discussion at that time by resulting from objections or otherwise as to the purpose of that evidence?
Correct. It comes in following the cross-examination.
But the judge did make an explanation after the cross-examination?
Yes, the judge said that you can only consider this and then listed the seven or eight reasons under 404. With the 15 seconds left, I will take my seat.
All right. Thank you, sir. You got some time left for rebuttal. Ms. Cassio?
May it please the court. I'll go through the same thing, the same order. As far as the sufficiency of the evidence, defendant expresses great concern that the lone employee at the Humboldt bus station could remember all of this. She is the only employee at that bus station. She is the only person. She has to lock it up when she leaves to go get something to eat because she is the only person. She is very conscious of who is in that bus station when they're there. She at one point expressed knowing certain individuals who are regulars, so she is aware. And she was aware of the facts surrounding this particular sale of a ticket because they were rather suspicious. And she detailed all of these different things. Two people come to the window, a male and a female. They purchase the ticket for the female. There was some discussion as to who it was going to be between them at first, but then they ultimately chose to purchase it for her, and likely it was because he had no ID on him. They purchase the ticket in her name, get a baggage claim check, which is the only one that this woman wrote for that bus that day. And that is in evidence in the on the exhibit list. You can see that.
As I understand it, there's no name that goes on the baggage claim check. Is that right?
That is correct.
What is actually on the claim check?
I believe the only thing on it is the point of origin, which in this case was Humboldt, Texas, and the point of destination, which was Shreveport. And there may have been some other identifying number on it because I believe there's a tear-off part that a person has that they can then make their claim for the check. So there's evidently some kind of number that identifies it so that the person keeps a part. But the part that the individual would keep was not found on either defendant or the co-defendant, Markia Atkins.
And the station agent doesn't need to see, or she did not testify that she would have attached this to whatever was being carried on the bus?
No, she did not do that. In fact, she was not aware that the ticket was going to be used by the male who was traveling until she saw him getting on the bus. And at the point she saw him getting on the bus, she saw him carrying the white bag and another bag, and there's no description of what that other bag was. So
they would have been responsible, wherever the passenger was, for carrying whatever was being checked from her to the bus that curbside?
Right. They get the ticket and their portion of the baggage claim check to put on whatever bag they have.
I guess they get the entire claim check, and then they tear off what they keep?
That's correct, but there is a, the agent has a, well, I think it's the agent's copy of the bus ticket. The agent keeps a copy of the bus ticket. There's an agent copy.
But not the claim check.
I don't believe there was a claim check, Your Honor. I think that is correct. I'm looking at the exhibit list right now, and it does not appear to be there. Defendant is comparing himself to an ordinary traveler when he discusses the effect that the large clothing or that the clothing would have on a jury looking at him trying these clothes on. However, this defendant is not an ordinary traveler. He is a drug courier, and that's what the government attempted to prove, that whoever owns that bag is a drug courier and is no ordinary traveler, so is going to, as Judge Wiener says, attempt to distance himself as far away from that bag as possible.
Well, that's certainly true, but isn't that more a closing argument? And it does seem to me that opposing counsel has a point. There is some relevance that you can respond to as you are right now, but isn't there some relevance to make the existence of a fact more likely than if the absence of that fact more likely than it otherwise would be? It seems to me the argument that there is some relevance is a good one.
There was much discussion of this, and there was testimony back and forth between two of the witnesses, Agent Sears and then I've forgotten Townley. I think he's a detective, but Townley was the other witness. And they were specifically asked about the size of the clothing, where the clothing was. The clothing was in the suitcase. The jury got to see the clothing. They took the suitcase back with them into deliberation, and on page 196.
Again, they took the suitcase?
Yes, Your Honor. The judge sent all of the evidence back with the jury.
Including the clothes?
Including the clothes were in the suitcase. They got to take everything back with them.
Was the clothing taken out of the suitcase in the courtroom?
I don't recall that it was. In fact, I don't think it was, Your Honor. It was not. But the jury had the suitcase with all of its contents with them. They had all of the evidence.
Were they aware that the defendant was making a point that they didn't fit him?
They were most surely aware of that through the questioning of the two witnesses concerning the clothes.
They got 2X and 3X.
They were not asked that question.
No, but I'm saying in the suitcase, there are T-shirts that are double X and triple X, and he's...
Double X.
Okay.
And there are pants that are waist size 38, the two pairs of pants.
And the defendant is 5'10", 165 or something like that?
No, Your Honor. He is, I believe, 5'11", close to 6 feet, and but between 180 and 200 pounds. So he's
38 could have fit.
Yes, Your Honor, it could have. And the jury can hold up the clothes and look at it and say, maybe so. They saw the defendant. Unlike this court, they did see the defendant and they did see the clothes. And they had every opportunity.
All he did not get was the opportunity to try them on.
That is correct. That is the only opportunity he did not get. It was to actually put the clothes on. And we don't know if he lost weight in the period of time between the time he was arrested and the time of trial, or gained weight. That's not known. So that is a possibility also. And the last argument with 404B, this is a classic 404B evidence. It is meant to show the method of operation, the modus operandi of this defendant. It shows his knowledge and his intent. And the judge instructed the jury after the testimony concerning the incident in Nacogdoches. The judge instructed the jury about this.
Let me ask, as opposing counsel was indicating that this comes out as the first witness at trial, and as far as the jurors knew, that's what this trial was about, this process, this particular day of going from Fort Houston, I forget where the point of origin was on that trip. Was it not explained that this was a prior incident until all the testimony was over?
It was after the testimony of that particular witness who testified about the Nacogdoches, Texas.
And redirect of that witness, then it was explained to the jury what just happened.
I believe so, but there were opening statements by the attorneys who explained what the order of the evidence was going to be, and I don't recall reading it, but I would think that that was definitely something that was included because it was a contested issue between the defendants and the government.
There was no pretrial motion in limine or other effort to keep this evidence out?
Your Honor, I truly do not recall.
There's no objection at trial to this testimony?
I believe defendant did object. The 404B, I just want to take a look one real quickly here. The judge did instruct, and he did instruct that it was for the purpose of showing knowledge, intent, and modus operandi. And the similarities between this offense and the actual offense, between the 404B offense and the actual offense that defendant committed are pretty striking. In the Nacogdoches case, it was from Houston to Monroe, Louisiana. In this case, it was from a town outside of Houston, but there is evidence that defendant had been in Houston going to Shreveport. Defendant and Atkins are both from Monroe originally, and that evidence was in there. The defendant had the drugs strapped to his body in the first instance on the bus. In this instance, he distanced himself by putting them in a bag. In both instances, it was crack cocaine was involved. In the first instance, it was only crack cocaine. In this one, it was crack cocaine and some powder cocaine. In both instances, he was traveling on a ticket that was not in his name. In both instances, he was, I'm trying to think of some of the other, but they were very, very similar situations.
And he got caught the first time and caught the second time.
Well, we don't know how many other times he didn't get caught, Your Honor. There was 2 years in between the first time he was caught and the second time. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, I yield the balance of my time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Aberle, you have the time for a moment.
Just a couple points. It is true that the jury most likely had access to this clothing during deliberation, but didn't have access to the defendant. And, you know, I don't know if the jury could see the defendant any better than I can see you now and be able to assess what they were trying so hard to prove was that these clothes were too big. Regarding the 404B evidence, there was a motion, but it apparently was off the record. And you can tell that somewhere in the transcript, you will see where counsel is basically saying, I want it on the record that I've made this objection, and the court, you know, puts that on the record. The discussion about the 404B matter is not on the record. Oddly, there is a ruling, a 404B ruling in the record that concerns other prior crimes, not the one that was tried. It's one of the document numbers.
I'm sure I'm the only one who didn't follow what you just said.
There is a written ruling, a written 404B ruling in this case.
In response to an in limine motion, is that what you're saying?
Well, the motion isn't in the record. But there is a ruling, and the court goes through some analysis. But it's talking about prior convictions that are not the conviction that we hear about at trial. So I don't know what to make of that. But I think it is clear from the trial transcript that an objection was made and is re-urged during the trial.
Were any other prior convictions discussed at trial?
No, sir. Okay. Which is odd when you have this ruling, this written ruling that basically allows them to come in. So I'm not sure what's happened there. And I was not trial counsel. Finally, regarding the modus operandi, really the only connection, the only thing that's similar between this and the prior crime is it's on the bus. And, you know, he might ride the bus all the time. But it's critical that, you know, he had the cocaine in his pocket then, and this time there's this elaborate business with drugs in a suitcase that have been checked. And comparing that one incident to this one incident I don't think establishes a modus operandi or a pattern. I think that's all that I have.
Okay. Mr. Aberle, you're court appointed, and You did a very good job for your client. The court appreciates very much your services. All right. Thank you very much. We call the next.